Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care. Working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Thursday, join us for a personal tour of Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S., a show co-hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Brook and attorney at law Alan Phillips. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your thoughts and questions. Let's go!
I'm Debbie Brook, founder of Homeopathy World Community. I will be speaking with our regular co-host, Alan Phillips, attorney at law. He is presently driving on his way home from a business meeting, and he will sign in shortly. Today is October 20th, 2011. I want to thank all of our listeners. We have reached over 25,000 listens, and it keeps growing. I want to thank you so much. I know that these recordings and radio shows are important to learn many different things about how we live and how we can keep healthy in mind, body, and spirit. We're going to give more information about Alan Phillips, attorney at law, who assists people with vaccination exemptions and waivers. He has written an incredible ebook. Many people have done click the download to find out what it's all about, to know whether they need to have a specialist, an expert in this area, or they can do it on their own, which is very possible in many states. Today we're going to be talking about are we living in a police state, and Alan has written a wonderful article about that. In the meantime, while we're waiting, I'd like to also let you know about the other shows on Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio. On Monday night, we have a brand new program that started this week at 8 p.m. Eastern Time with Grant Bentley, naturopath and homeopath. It's called Homeopathy and Facial Analysis. It is rather advanced listening, so you have to jump in, and if you've got comments and questions, we welcome them. It is targeted for the homeopath specifically, but certainly physicians and other people can listen in. I see that Alan is in the studio now, so I will let him in. In the meantime, I will continue also to talk about the different shows that we have. So, and on Wednesday, we have Dr. Adil Jimpalawala Kasim, who is a MD cardiologist in India. He has a special clinic specifically to deal with cardiology patients. And his topic of discussion is heart health and homeopathy. He's been talking the last number of weeks all about hypertension. It has been incredible learning experience. So I advise you to get on and listen or download the show for your convenient listening. On Thursdays, obviously, we have Vaccinations and Your Rights with Alan Phillips, and we talk about many issues dealing with the vaccination issues in contemporary life. We also will have, following up at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, Dr. Christina Chambreau, veterinarian and homeopath, talk about pet health. So far, we have discussed the seven keys to keeping your pet healthy and happy. We have also talked about what to do with fleas and how we can keep our home and environment and our pets free of fleas. And then today we're going to be talking about thyroid health. And lastly, on the Sunday night evening, we have a meditation to get us started for the new week in a place of relaxation and positive intention and affirmations. Okay, so Alan, I have given a little bit of an intro today, and we're getting some little background sound. I hope you can hear
me. My apologies.
That's okay, great. So I wanted to kind of introduce the show today with a quote that says, by Johann Wolfgang von Goethe, says, "None are more hopelessly enslaved than those who falsely believe they are free." And it's possible that propaganda or whatever mindset we have can put us up in a place where we think, yeah, everything is cool. You know, we can do and say what we please without hurting another person. Yet today we're really in a trial period about that saying, that quote from Goethe. Alan, if you want to talk, introduce anything else, and I also, we want to describe exactly the term police state and what it means, what it is, so that everybody is on the same page to start.
Sure, and for starters, let me say that I have, as a personal and professional policy, I avoid or try to avoid as much as I reasonably can sensationalism, use of sensationalistic terms or exaggeration. I try to be objective and clear. And I think the phrase, and I've written an article recently entitled "The Beginning of the Vaccine Police State?" ? I don't mean to suggest with that term that we are in a vaccine police state. I use that term because I see what for me is a disturbing trend with the movement forward, aggressive movement of the pro-vaccine industry or camp, however else you would want to frame or phrase or define that, but on multiple fronts. And we'll talk about some of those, the different parts of that today, and then why I'm using the term police state. But as far as the phrase itself, police state, I think it's a term that probably doesn't have a really precise, specific definition. But in general, it refers to a condition in which the government exercises very rigid and repressive controls over social, economic, political affairs within a population. One definition that I've got, and this is probably from a Wikipedia definition. Wikipedia, I think, really is a good information source for a lot of general kinds of information and even some specialized or specific information. And I liked what they had to say about this in terms of the general definition. A police state typically exhibits elements of totalitarianism, social control. There is little or no distinction between the law and the exercise of political power. These are things
by the executive.
By the executive, right. The person or entities in control. The word executive power, as would apply here in the states right now, would be considered at the state level the governors and any agencies, executive agencies or people working for and under the governor, and at the federal level, the president is the executive authority. In a maybe historically, police states would be more common in a dictatorship or other tightly, rigidly controlled kind of government structure. But my concern is not that that the word police state applies now, because I believe certainly it doesn't. But what I do believe is that that there's a very aggressive pro-vaccine agenda by government and industry. And the reality in our current situation, current state of affairs, is that there's no real clear line between government and industry, not only in healthcare but in other areas as well, that industry has so influenced and in some cases outright infiltrated government that a lot of our federal agencies, probably state agencies as well, make decisions that are supposedly in the best interest of the population, but really are guided and skewed and steered toward the benefit to the industry that is influencing control. So it's really hard to draw any sort of clear lines and say on this side is government and on the other side is industry. There's really an intermingling of the two in a very disturbing level and ways at times.
Alan, I think another component, I mean, you have sort of two things, government and industry. I think it's really a triangle, because I would put media in there. And the difference today is the internet, because typically you think government control, and if they're in bed with industry, then you see the marketing and the propaganda, the message that you receive through the media. And if you have a controlled media, then you're only going to get that particular message. But today, as much as I don't know how free internet really is, but the fact that we're doing our own show, that people can have a voice in this way, can seep out other messages that might be in opposition to what the powerful media industry and government have.
Boy, that's an excellent point, Debbie, and I you used the word triangle there as I think, quite apt. And we have, in the same way that we have industry influence of government policy and law, we have, of course, very profound industry influence and control over the media as well. And whereas the word police state usually is a reference to government, here, I think we're talking about a mixture of industry and government, and to some degree and in some instances, lack of clarity between the two, perhaps. But within that, then, absolutely is media. It's really interesting. A lot of people in the vaccine awareness community very reasonably feel a need and desire to try and get mainstream media to address some of the suppressed information so that we could have eventually and finally a truly objective and open public conversation about vaccination and many other issues for that matter. But I don't think that's a bad thing. I think that'd be wonderful if that happened. But, you know, there's been a trend in recent years, Debbie, for people going more and more to the internet and electronic sources for information and less relying on the 6 o'clock news. And we might do just as well to reinforce that trend, or to look for ways to utilize that trend. And this show is one classic example. But we have to be vigilant in this arena as well, because there have been and continue to be efforts to restrict or control information flow on the internet. We need to have our eyes and ears open about that. For the very reason that this is a way that alternative viewpoints can be accessed and expressed. And there are, of course, those who don't want these views to be aired. Mm-hmm. So we need to be vigilant and watchful in this area as well, to make sure we don't lose any of the current freedoms we have to communicate electronically. But there are several different things in recent events that, again, taken together, prompted me to use that phrase, police state, not because I think we have one, but because I think the pro-vaccine agenda is an open-ended agenda. And if it continues down the path that it is currently taking, as indicated by past and recent events, the end result is going to be something potentially very like a police state. And I think it is important for all of us to take note of these events individually and collectively, and to recognize what's happening, and to not wait until we're too far down this road to change the direction we're going.
Right. I also just posted, for those who are on the network and listening in the live chat, don't forget to go onto the live chat, favorite the show, and become a friend. I have an article written about net neutrality, and so I put a link to that in case anybody is interested. Yeah, it is an important issue. So what did you want to So we have to be vigilant. You know, the other thing I wanted to make a comment about is that just because we want to be independent and we want to talk about issues in our own way, and so we go ahead and take our news from the internet and alternative media, it does not mean that we should not pay attention to what is going on in the mainstream media also, because we can learn a lot from them and find out what are their tactics, what message are they portraying, and how do we respond to them.
Absolutely. I mean, it's vaccines is absolutely a multifaceted issue. There are, of course, many different health issues, medical issues, issues about the science. What is the science? How reliable are different sources on the medical and scientific ends? And of course, it's highly political. Who's doing what and why? And what are the professed motivations? What are the real motivations? And this can all be different for individual vaccines. Each one has their own story, and so it's just such a multifaceted issue. It really is important to try to keep at least some kind of tabs with mainstream as well as alternative media. I couldn't agree with you more on that. Let's talk about some of these different recent events in particular here, so we can give people listeners a feel for why I have uncharacteristically for myself resorted to a phrase, vaccine police state.
Mm-hmm. Well, you will get the attention. I hope from the right people. Okay.
Okay. Well, at the end of last month, Sacramento's News 10 TV station reported that the Natoma school officials were actually going door-to-door with a traveling nurse to give whooping cough vaccines to unvaccinated students. Now, this has been an issue unique to California in that they just recently enacted a new legal mandate. They added another vaccine that now all of the middle schoolers and high schoolers have to get in order to continue attending school, unless, of course, you have an exemption. Now, California has a very broadly worded exemption, basically something to the effect of, if you have beliefs that are contrary to this, then you can opt out. And it's such a broad term that I think it would clearly encompass religious and non-religious beliefs. And it seems to me that the wording of the exemption was probably deliberate in the sense that they just wanted to not get caught up with trying to decide whether somebody's beliefs were religious or not, for example, in maybe it's a reason not to have a separate religious exemption, which many states do. In fact, most states do. But in any case, there's been a lot of confusion about this. There have been many students whose parents weren't exercising the exemption, but who hadn't gotten vaccinated, and individual schools kind of caught in the middle of this. Do they just make all these kids go home? Because there's been significant numbers, at least in some schools and some districts. So it's been confusing. But and of course, if somebody shows up at your door, I don't think you're lawfully required to let them in and vaccinate you or your children. But people who are in the pro-vaccine choice part of the vaccine controversy, many of us were quite alarmed by the idea of someone going door to door. You know, if I want a vaccine, I'll make sure my kid gets it. If I don't, you know, it's not your business; it's my choice.
You would think that we get enough messages about vaccination, considering no matter where we go, we get the swine flu vaccine at your drugstore, at your grocery store, at wherever your department store. I mean, there's no place now that you don't see that message. And then they send a message home, and they probably even call you. And then when you register your child for school, I'm sure you get a message. So it's really everywhere. So now they're trying a new method of getting compliance.
Right, and perhaps even more of a concern to me, because I remember seeing some of the chatter on the internet about this and the outrage of this by people in the alternative vaccine community. You know, gee, it's not like California has money to spare and they can pay people to go door to door. You know, how are they doing this? And I don't know the answer in this specific instance, but what I do know is that the recall a specific name of the act here. The and I know I've got it here in my notes. I'll pull it up in a second. But the federal healthcare bill, the Obamacare that was passed in March of last year, 2010. That bill set aside millions of dollars for the federal funds to not only to purchase vaccines directly from vaccine manufacturers, but to create grants for states to do a number of different vaccine promotional activities, including, and it was specified in the legislation, going door to door. Here, the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. That's the formal name there. I found that rather disturbing, again, because I think that given all of the controversy around vaccines and given that this is at one very important and critical level a rights issue and a legal issue, that we have the right to one degree or another in any mandatory vaccine situation to exercise exemptions, to say no. It's a very limited right and really needs to be expanded on considerably so that in any vaccine context, anyone involved has the right to make an informed choice. We're a long way from having that level of freedom and personal autonomy about our bodies in terms of the laws that are on the books presently, but even the relatively limited ability that we have to do that exists to one degree or another in any situation where vaccines are required. And the idea that the federal government would be spending money paying people to go door to door, I know this article concerning California, the information I had there that they had spent a whole day and they had visited 12 households and given 6 vaccines and you know in one day. And I'm thinking, that seems like a really inefficient use where you've got school officials, they don't say how many, but they say plural, going door-to-door with a traveling nurse. It sounds like they've got at least 3 people, and maybe more, that are being paid to go door-to-door and administer vaccines. It just doesn't strike me as a particularly efficient use of their time and money. But they've got an admittedly tricky situation. The legislature has mandated this new vaccine, and then they have large numbers of people who haven't gotten it, and somebody has to do something, you know, to deal with that. But you have a right to say no.
Are there any other, besides the census, is there any other time when people go, when the government officials go door to door? I mean, strange.
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I can't think of any off the top of my head. I mean, on sort of a canvassing basis, you know, where you're just sort of going out to large numbers of people, I'm sure there are any number of instances where local or even non-local government officials are knocking on somebody's door, but as just sort of a go down the list and go to all these people, I'm not aware off the top of my head of situations where that happens other than...
The only thing that I can think of, well, maybe it's only state government. Let's say there's something going on at the coast where there's going to be a hurricane. They go to door to door to make sure that you are safe by getting out, you know, if they're evacuating. Is that the
right
state, that's a state, local kind of mandate. So in the, on terms of federally, I can only think of the census. And of course, if there are people who are nonprofit agencies who go door to door, which we get quite often, you probably could put up no solicitation, and that might turn them away.
Well, no one, of course, has to answer the door, and unless there were some sort of emergency context and a government order or something equivalent, health department mandate, you know, people don't have to answer the door. They can say no, thank you. I doubt that the way this is being carried out is aggressive in the on the level of the interaction between the officials and people at various homes. Although I don't have any specific information one way or the other on that, but it's more the principle that we've gone from a place now where, you know, vaccines are mandated to get into school, and then you either get the vaccines or you exercise the exemption or your child can't go to school. I mean, in one sense, it is really that straightforward. But and I expect that if rather than sending a nurse and school officials door-to-door, they just told the students, I'm sorry, you can't come to school today, and sent them back home, I expect the parents would then very quickly either get a vaccine or exercise an exemption and take care of it. I think the problem was that some of the school principals are thinking, and I think they quoted one in the article that I was reading, is saying, gee, I'm required to provide an education, I'm required to keep them out for a vaccine. It was sort of seen as a conflicting laws, and they didn't really know what to do about it. I didn't find that real credible, because to me, it's the state laws, as I understand them, are generally pretty clear on the issue. You get whatever the vaccines are, you have an exemption, or you can't come to school. And if one day they just sent, you know, one third of the school population home, if that's how many of them didn't have the vaccines, I imagine most parents would then do something pretty quick to remedy the situation one way or the other. But I can certainly see a school principal saying, and I have no idea what percentage of students, but I do know it's significant, that if it's a large enough number of students that you are turning away and sending home, that is going to disrupt the education process potentially in a significant way. So maybe there is a, you know, genuine concern about the sort of more strict interpretation of the law on the part of a school principal there. But again, I'm not – any of these things we're talking about looked at in isolation maybe don't look so bad. What really, again, drove me to that phrase with a question mark about vaccine police state was these items looked at collectively. So let's talk about some of the other ones here, because right now, as far as I know, this is an isolated instance of door-to-door, but I also know that there are federal funds set aside in grant, as grant money for states to fund going door-to-door, and I expect we're going to hear more of this. I don't think this will remain the isolated instance that, as far as I know, it is at this point, but we'll look to see if there's more. But we had another situation where the CDC, in collaboration with the University of Chicago, is sending out letters to residents around the country and making phone calls and saying, you have been selected to be part of a national immunization survey, and you're going to get a call from the NORC at the University of Chicago, and have your children's immunization records handy. I have seen posted on Natural News an article about this and copies of the letter that they're sending out. I don't see anything overly aggressive or coercive in the language of the letter, or, people I think have the right to opt out of the survey. So again, looked at as an isolated activity, it doesn't look particularly horrible in and of itself whatsoever, although a lot of people, I think especially in the alternative vaccine camp, see that as somewhat invasive. You know, granted, maybe I don't have to participate in the survey if I don't want to, but still, that's somebody reaching into my personal household and asking for information about my immunization status. And is that something that is really the business of the federal government or not? I mean, the federal government has made it its business. And so maybe the more strict question there is, should that be the case, and should that be how we're spending federal dollars? I'm presuming, again, I don't know specifically if this is funded by the Patient and Affordable Care Act that I mentioned, but there are grant monies set aside in that act that would cover this kind of an activity. So again, I while this is, as far as I know, an isolated instance, I again think that this is something that we can expect to see along with other aggressive measures more and more. I mean, in one sense, the pharmaceutical vaccine manufacturing industry really only has two goals in one sense as it pertains to vaccines, and that is everybody who's mandated to get a vaccine needs to be mandated to get more vaccines, And everyone who's not mandated currently to get a vaccine needs to be mandated to get a vaccine, needs to be put into that first category. And I see evidence of this, just on an ongoing basis, not just with the general what some of us believe is propaganda about the necessity, need, and safety of vaccines generally, which has been going on for many, many years at this point, but things such as now we have new behaviors and new activities, people going door to door, people making phone calls and sending letters, and federal funds being set aside to support these kinds of activities. And then, you know, just all these things taken together. Now, I've actually heard in recent weeks from entirely new categories of people. For the last several years, in fact, since early in 2003, I've been working with people here in my own state of North Carolina, but also around the country, in a wide variety of different contexts concerning vaccine exemptions and waivers. And this comes up in many different areas, far more than I originally had any idea of when I first got into this work. Of course, in public schools, which is the first thing that most people think of when you talk about vaccine requirements and exemptions. But there are separate issues with private schools, with homeschoolers, with military schools, with colleges and universities, and college programs that involve healthcare programs that involve students having to do clinical work in local hospitals or other healthcare facilities. All of these can have different law that applies. And then you've got military, which can different concerns and law can apply to military members versus military families versus military schools, children in military schools, and military contractors. We've got immigration.
So right now you're just giving us a list of how much immunizations have infiltrated into the lives of the citizens and the different ways that they do that?
And society and culture, how pervasive and widespread mandates and therefore issues concerning exemptions and waivers are. And the reason I'm giving the list, and aside from just helping listeners to understand that it is more most people, for example, when you talk about exemptions, vaccine requirements, with or without the context of exemptions being added, people think about school, and that's probably the most common arena, but it has all these other arenas where there are vaccine mandates and issues, corresponding issues with exemptions and waivers. And the other primary category of the ones I just mentioned would be employees, and for the most part, I see that in the healthcare arena with healthcare employees. But I've seen completely new categories come up. So I've had all these different arenas that I've dealt with for several years now, but this year I've heard from new categories. And frankly, only from healthcare employees, mainly only in the last couple of years since the so-called pandemic, because there's now policy sweeping the country where hospitals are mandating flu and sometimes other vaccines where they have not, for their employees, where they have not done that in years past. I've had more than one nurse call me and say, I've been working at this hospital for 30 years and I've never been required to get a vaccine, and now they're requiring us to get the flu shot. And by the way, it's the ones who get the shot every year who end up taking time off from work because they're sick.
Right, so what are the other new categories that people have been calling you about?
Well, I've heard from pharmacists and a few of them in the last few weeks, one in particular from California who says, I'm required now to get the flu shot. I'm required to give the flu shot at the pharmacy. And, of course, they have to take a training with other pharmacists to learn how to give the shot, and they get to practice on each other there in the training. And he's also required to employ suggestive selling. Everybody who comes to the counter, he now has to say, would you like fries with that? Of course, right. He has to say flu shots, not fries. But
I
say it that way because it's so silly. Because we, you know, we've all heard of the, you know, would you like fries with that? And you go to the post office, and now they have to do that too. Would you know? Is there anything else you need, or we can get you? And that's, I guess, on one level, that's sound marketing. But the particular person who called me just was just repulsed by all three of those requirements.
It could be courteous, you know, to make sure, you know, you didn't forget something or, in you know, it depends on the perspective of the listener, how they take it. But if they're, usually they say, do you want a candy bar that's next to the thing that's on sale? But if they're saying, do you want a flu shot or a candy bar, you know, where do you draw the line on what they can say to influence you?
Well, from the point of view of, from a business point of view, a cold calculating business point of view, of course that makes perfect sense. You want to sell as much of whatever it is that you have to sell, and you want to really push the things that are most profitable. And from a mainstream vaccine point of view, that's a perfectly wonderful and reasonable thing to offer. Oh, thanks for reminding me. Yeah, I would like a flu shot because I don't want to get the flu. I want to be healthy, and I want to do my part to protect the rest of the community from infectious disease. And those are sort of the mainstream beliefs in quick summary. And it would be your – I mean, I've seen people announce to friends or coworkers that they're going to go get their flu shot, and there's this sense of – patriotism. You know, I'm doing my community duty here, and, you know, I'm proud. I'm going to get my flu shot. And if you don't have the information to suggest that there might be problems with that, maybe that is a very reasonable point of view. The problem, of course, is that there's any number of reasons that I could rattle on and quickly use up the rest of the show as to why you might want to reconsider whether or not to get that flu shot. And I'm not so much concerned ultimately with people's choices individually as I am that we all have the right to make an informed choice, and that the person pushing a flu shot is doing so in a manner that's with integrity and ethical. And given the independent research on flu shots, which the Cochrane collaboration in particular, that has said, well, actually, they don't work. They don't cut down on working days lost. They don't cut down on hospital admissions. But they did find widespread evidence of manipulation of conclusions in the studies that they reviewed. You know, that kind of and level of problem, the implications there are profound and far-reaching, and should stop anyone from just sort of reflexively saying, oh, yes, it's fall, time to go get my flu shot. And so, of course, it's only complicated further, the problems are amplified more as the pharmacies or anybody else gets more aggressive in pushing the flu vaccine. And this could be said for any vaccine. You know, each vaccine maybe has its own particular story and unique aspects. But
can I go back and ask you? I mean, this is going back to the original discussion. Dr. Bob asked, does the pharmacy companies contribute to the traveling vaccinators, to that funding source in the government?
Well, anybody who pays taxes is contributing to, you know, by way of taxes to federal dollars, some of which are, again, are set aside to fund grants to the states to do all these other different kinds of activities. So beyond that sort of general answer, I don't have any specific information. But what I have seen over and over again is that the what I sometimes refer to as the follow the money syndrome, I mean, that shows up and applies just about everywhere. You know, when you dig beneath the surface, what you see behind the, oh, we're doing this for public health or the good of the public or, you know, whatever it is in any issue, when you dig beneath it, the vast majority of the time, what you will eventually find is that what's really going on is that somebody's profiting because things are being set up the way they are, and the money really explains how and why things work the way they work, far more so and more consistently so than any of the reasons that are given up front.
So we don't really have the information at hand that draws a line from the source of the funding for these federal grants are from pharmaceutical companies. We don't have that information. Whether it is true or not true, we don't know. Did you want to talk about what you said here in your article, that the states and private industry have been acting aggressively to increase the number of vaccine mandated and to implement entirely new vaccine requirements? Now, the third thing that you said is, while taking steps to unlawfully restrict access to vaccine exemptions. That's quite powerful.
There have been, the two classic examples, and I feel sure we've talked about these in past shows, so I'll give a brief treatment of them today. But Washington State recently passed a law making it more difficult to get exemptions, and in a manner that, frankly, I think is unconstitutional. Now, somebody who thinks something is unconstitutional, that doesn't make it, technically speaking, unconstitutional. A law really, formally, is not unconstitutional unless and until a court rules on it. So, strictly speaking, when I'm saying I think a law is unconstitutional, what that means is that my professional legal assessment is that, in effect, that if the law were challenged in court, that the court would far more likely than not rule that the law is unconstitutional. And you might recall me having said in the past, I wrote up a constitutional assessment and got that to activists in Washington State. They took it to the governor's office along with other concerns that they had about this law. And when presented with the question of constitutionality, the representative of the governor's office said, well, that's not really our area. That's up to the courts to decide that. Now, technically speaking, that was correct, because it is the courts who have the say as to whether or not a law is unconstitutional, but a very disingenuous response nonetheless, because the legal argument, in my opinion, is not some sort of rare, obscure, let me see if I can convince a judge of this kind of thing. It really is pretty straightforward in the legal world. And I genuinely do believe that a court making a proper ruling over the question of constitutionality of this law would have to find that it is unconstitutional, at least as it pertains to the restriction on religious exemptions. But nonetheless, the law got passed, and what this teaches us is nothing new, but historically, but something perhaps new conceptually to many of us, and that is the reality that laws that, for all practical purposes, are unconstitutional can be passed, and probably are being passed all the time. If they have the votes, they can do that. If they don't have enough votes to override a governor veto, they can do it as long as they have the votes and the governor's blessing. If they have enough votes to override a governor veto, they can do it without the governor. But the bottom line is there, it's about the votes in the state legislatures and not about some more abstract question, but very important question as to the constitutionality of it. An even more blatant example just happened in California, where they've passed a bill that allows 12-year-olds to consent to vaccines. And there's a line of U.S. Supreme Court precedent that clearly lays out the a 14th Amendment due process right for parents to parent their children. And any time a state takes any parental authority away from a parent and gives it to anyone else outside of an emergency. I mean, I think most of us would agree that if a child is, let's say, injured in a car accident and going to die or suffer serious permanent harm if they don't get immediate attention, you don't want the doctor to wait until they can find the parents and get their permission. The doctor is going to do whatever they have to do to save the child's life and so forth. But in a outside of an emergency context,
This was actually passed.
This has been passed. The governor has signed it, is my understanding.
Okay.
Because it's been on the discussion board in the alternative vaccine community for many weeks now. But there's a let me give you a quick example. There's a 1979 U.S. Supreme Court case, Parham versus J.R. It was a a case concerning a parent's right to request that a child be committed to institutionally because of severe health problems, and whether the child had a right to go through some sort of formal legal process as a matter of due process rights. And the court determined that the child really didn't have that right here because there were enough other safeguards built in. It wasn't just a parent, say, commit the child, and then it happens. The parent makes that request. The child goes through assessment evaluations by more than one psychiatrist, and there was just a lot of safeguards built into it so that the likelihood for abuse was really minimal. But anyway, a quote from this case, what the case was looking at, what are the rights of a child, whatever a parent's rights for their own minor. Here's a quote from that case. Most children, even in adolescence, simply are not able to make sound judgments concerning many decisions, including the need for medical care or treatment. Parents can and must make those judgments. Medical care and treatment of minors. This U.S. Supreme Court says parents can and must make those judgments. Now, this is just one of several cases that could be cited for a parent's due process right. Because, in effect, when a state takes any authority away from a parent and gives it to anybody else, even another adult or professional, give that decision to doctors, that would almost make sense. But when they do that, what they are doing is declaring, in effect, that all the parents in the state are unfit with regard to those particular issues, unfit to make decisions in those particular issues. Well, you can't. Parents are deemed to be fit unless and until they are dragged into court or some other formal proceeding and evidence is presented and somebody looks at the evidence from both sides and decides, yes, this parent is unfit, and then there's some sort of ruling or adjudication or order or what have you. You know, you can't just decide sort of by default that all parents are unfit to make a decision, so we're going to give it to someone else. Now, that's about giving it to anybody else. When you take decision away from parents and give it to their children, it's just absurd on its face. This does not pass the common sense test that somehow children can make a decision because they're better capable of making the decision than their parents are. Or we don't need to have their parents involved. Let's let the kids do it. By definition, kids legally are incompetent. And in, legally, that term is not a condescending term or offensive term. It just means that they are, as we all know, children are not as mature as adults. They are immature or in developmental stages that we hope people who are legal adults have grown out of. But legally and just sort of factually, you know, developmentally, psychologically, medically, children are not in a position to make important decisions for themselves. That's why they're minors, called minors, why there is a legal age, 18
so,
for most purposes.
So we have a question. Dr. Bob is asking, how come they can give the HPV vaccine to 12-year-olds without parental permission? And, you know, is there an opt-out on that?
Well, by opt-out, I think when a child, by saying that a child can consent, I think the child can just as easily say no thank you. But how many children, if there are peers around them, if there are, let's say, teachers, if this could happen in the school environment?
They could easily be pressured. So essentially, he's really touching upon that constitutional amendment, the 14th, did you say, constitutional
14th,
amendment?
14th, right.
Yes.
Well, I mean, the short answer is yes, they can do it because they've already done it. They've done it here in North Carolina. They've done it in California. There may be other states where they've done it. Should they be able to do it? No. Can we do anything about it? Yes. We can challenge these laws in court. We can organize and demand that our legislators repeal this kind of absurd law. But can they do it? Yes, and that's the point I was making earlier with the Washington state law. State legislatures can apparently pass anything they want to. And it's not up to them as a technical legal requirement, although it certainly seems like as a patriotic duty, they ought to be asking themselves, and if they're unsure, professionals, whether or not a proposed law is constitutional. There ought to be safeguards in the legislative process to keep ridiculously unconstitutional laws like this from ever even getting through the system to a vote. But obviously there aren't. Or if there are, the processes used allowed something like this to slide through. I mean, I'm sure there's somebody who will take the other side and say, well, no, this really is constitutional and here's why. But I haven't heard or seen a convincing counter argument. To me, this one doesn't even pass the common sense test. Oh, give children a right, rights to make important medical decisions without the parents' consent. That just doesn't pass the common sense test, before you get to the technical legal analysis. But can they do it? Yes, they have done it. And what do we do about it? Fight it in court or fight it legislatively.
Right, so you think this might actually go to the Supreme Court if somebody does have an issue at some point?
Well, if somebody would challenge it in state court or potentially, I guess, federal court because it raises a federal issue. And then depending on the ruling, if anybody appeals it, it could theoretically go up to a circuit court and then perhaps even up to the U.S. Supreme Court. But it would start in a...
start at the state level.
State or federal level, it could probably this issue is when it could probably be brought in either state or federal court.
Mm-hmm.
But it would have to start at the trial court level, and then depending on whether or not anybody who didn't like the ruling thought there was a basis for appeal and appealed that it could go on up. But there is precedent from the U.S. Supreme Court that has application here to this issue that. To me, very clearly screams unconstitutional with regard to this particular law. And so there's not only a sort of common sense basis for challenging it in terms of parental authority generally, there's a deep concern that what is really happening here is that the pharmaceutical industry is bypassing the growing number of concerned parents so they can go directly to the children to administer vaccines. There have already been efforts in the past to experiment with using schools as vaccine distribution and administration points. And where we're pointed to is kids are going to be vaccinated in school whether or not the parents object, whether or not the parents have or could have a valid legal exemption.
I think a lot of the people that are going door to door, they must be homeschoolers. And that's the trend, to have to make sure that your child is not being influenced, like very religious parents and families, believe that there are things being taught in school that is not to their liking, to their belief system, and therefore, maybe that's where they're going in neighborhoods where there are a lot of homeschoolers. We have only a few minutes left to the show. And so I would like to ask you to sum up and let us know anything that we should about this topic. I will put the link to your article for those people who want to read in depth, which I did. It's at libertyroundtable.com. And I mentioned earlier in the show that you have an e-guide for people to download concerning exemptions and waivers. It's really an excellent thing to get you started about constitutionality, your legal rights, and probably you could fill in on that. You just click on Homeopathy World Community. There's a link on the main page of that website.
Sure. The ebook is designed to give you the information you need to be able to make informed decisions, effective decisions concerning exemptions and waivers, and in a wide variety of contexts. It talks about all those different areas that I talked about before. I've heard from airline pilots earlier this year, another airline employee. I had never in my career before a few weeks ago heard from anybody in the airline industry saying, I'm required to get vaccines. How do I get out of it? These different things we've discussed today collectively go to the comment I made in the middle of the show earlier today about how the agenda is to find everybody who's not mandated and to impose a mandate, and also to find everybody who's already mandated to get vaccines and add more vaccines to the schedule. There's over 330 vaccines that are either already on the market or in development. I do not see a light at the end of this tunnel in the sense of, well, you know, it's like I get calls from nurses saying we have to get the flu vaccine, you know, and occasionally some will say, well, I'm not sure, maybe I'll just go ahead and get the vaccine. And one of my responses to that is, this is not an end point. The flu vaccine is a starting point. Next year they're going to require you to get the MMR or the DTaP, and I've already been hearing from nurses who have said we're required to get the flu shot and the DTaP or and the MMR. They're going to be adding more vaccines everywhere that there is a mandate. Whatever the current mandate is, there's going to be more vaccines added to that in the future. If you're not mandated, you're an adult, you're not a healthcare worker, and you say, well, I don't have to get a vaccine, thank God, I don't have to worry about that anymore. Well, I think you will. I can't say when for any given person, but I think it's just a matter of time because the agenda is that everybody needs to be mandated. So these are all issues we should be taking seriously as independent individual events and issues, but also collectively. This is part of a larger kind of global agenda in both the literal and figurative sense of that word, global. It's moving forward aggressively, and this is something that we need to get involved with. Now, you can go to pandemicresponseproject.com and join an email list there, and I send out occasional emails about legislative issues, vaccine legislative issues, but I highly recommend going to the National Vaccine Information Center's advocacy portal. There's a link to that.
NVIC.org.
They have a link on that page to their advocacy portal. That's where you can stay on top of what's going on legislatively in your state.
Great. Okay, we're going to sign off today, and up next is going to be Dr. Christina Chambreau, veterinarian, talking about thyroid issues and your pets. So thank you once again, Alan. I appreciate you coming on, and we'll see you next week. You'll surprise us with the topic.
I will do that.
Okay.
Take care.
Thank you for listening to Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S. with co-hosts Alan Phillips and Debbie Brook on Homeopathy World Community Radio. Remember to educate before you vaccinate.
Allow our souls to shine.